Good afternoon. So, last time we had a lecture recording because of the weather. And in that recording, talked about command injection, which I think is review. So this is kind of just the generalization of SQL injection. Because the idea is that we form some sort of command, be it for SQL or for the command line or anything like that, and we include some untrusted or at least not trustworthy input in there, and that ends up, you know, not being part of like a constant or an argument, but being a new command when it's not supposed to be able to. And we talked about one, you know, technique for sort of targeting that type of vulnerability, and also something which we can also think of as kind of a general reverse engineering slash program analysis technique called dynamic taint tracking, where the idea is that we can track the flow of data through a program by saying we're going to, for every value in our program, mark it as tainted or not tainted. And every time we do a computation, we're going to say if the inputs to this computation, any of them are tainted, the output's tainted. And we can actually refine this to, instead of saying tainted or not tainted, we can say comes from, you know, input bytes 1 through 7, and we can pass through that information. And I gave the example that Perl has this feature where it has this tainted or not tainted information with every single value in the language interpreter. And it uses this such that you can turn on a flag and it will just mark inputs as tainted. And when you try to use them in something like the run a shell command function, it will say, oops, don't do that. And there are specific operations that do a computation on a value to produce a result and remove that taintedness. So that's kind of as a feature for avoiding command injection sort of attacks in general, which for some reason, I showed you Perl because there's not other popular programming languages which do this, and Perl is a lot less popular than it once was. But we can also apply this idea to assembly and machine code. And there are emulators where we make the emulator do this taint tracking, but instead of on variables, on registers and bytes of memory, and bytes of data on disk, if we're doing like a whole machine, virtual machine. Obviously, this has a huge slowdown, but it lets us kind of easily ask questions like, hey, I have this piece of malware that I know somehow takes this input from the network and does something with it. What is it doing? We can kind of quickly answer that question, you know, and if we're doing a whole virtual machine, even if it like goes between processes and all that, we can kind of quickly answer that question. And we mentioned that if an attacker is actually worried about us doing this analysis, there are techniques they can do to fool it, because the idea of we computed a value using another value is kind of imprecise. So, for example, if I have an if statement that depends on that value, usually in these dynamic taint analysis, we don't mark that as tainted. Mark everything we do after that if statement as tainted, but obviously, you know, we could use this to copy the whole value if we wanted good enough if statements. And similarly, we can have computations that use a value, but in a way which doesn't matter if we just want to fool this type of analysis. And then we moved on to talk about what will be our main topic for a while, which is buffer overflows, starting with buffer overflows on the stack. And I believe you've seen kind of an introduction to this in Intro Cyber, and maybe the kind of buffer overflows we started with in Intro Cyber, where we have a buffer on the stack, we have some function that reads into that buffer and doesn't know how big the buffer is, and therefore we can overwrite something that happens to be next to it on the stack. And we saw some examples where, well, there was a very convenient variable that an attacker would be interested in, just happened to be right. And kind of the challenge for exploiting this is we need to figure out, well, where is that relative to our buffer? So we know like how much to input. And how is our input going to be interpreted in that format? So we have the example of we're inputting a string, but the thing we're overwriting is actually a number. We need to think of, well, how do the bytes of our string get interpreted as a number to choose what number we want to set that to? So questions about anything we covered last time? So, because I want us to have, for our topic about sort of extending these buffer overflow idea, we want to be comfortable figuring out how the stack is laid out. It's going to be very important. So here I have a function where if the stack is laid out correctly, we can overwrite this needed hash when we have input into our buffer. So my question is, where is needed hash relative to the beginning of that buffer? So I'll give you a couple minutes to work through this. You can check your answer with your neighbor. Okay, so who can tell me where either buffer or needed hashes in either on the stack or in the assembly code?
Behind where this RSP was, but when the vulnerable is called.
So it's the initial RSP minus 40.
Yeah.
And how did you get that?
Well, the easiest way, I think, is to look at the assembly, where you can see, like, the last LEA, where it's, like, 144 plus RSP. So, basically, we're calling memcopy, or memcompare, on needhash XFS. So needhash is in REI, so that's how you get to that line. And then RSP has been 184 less than it was originally for that original detection.
Okay. So you're saying, okay, it's 144 plus RSP here, and that becomes RDI when memcomp is called, therefore that's the first RDI to memcomp. Yeah, so that is needed hash, and it is RSP plus 144 at this point. You said that's 40 bytes from the initial value of RSP. Be careful about that, and this will be relevant for things we're doing later, is that it's the value of RSP here, but this is an additional 16 bytes of the initial value because of those two pushes at the top of the function. And this is going to be something we're going to be very careful about in the future, because we're going to talk about overwriting return addresses. And the return addresses is after those two push values. So we want to make sure we don't miss that in the future. For this example, it doesn't really matter, but it's going to matter in the future. And so, like this strategy, and I think the easiest strategy in this case, we know they're arguments to functions, we can kind of trace back from the function calls. And I can do the same thing for getUs. So the first argument to getUs is an RDI that comes from RPB, which comes from RSP, so it's the value of RSP here. And I can also do the same sort of calculation for actual hash, knowing it's the second argument to compute SHA, or the second argument to memcomp, and I get this stack layout, where I'm relative to the value of RSP when the main body of the function is running, in my example. So, if we want to do the attack where we overwrite needed hash, what are we going to input as our buffer? We're going to input something, a null character, so compute SHA-256 won't read the rest of the string we input, and a bunch of junk that gets us, so we have our something, /0, then a bunch of junk, and then the hash of something, which would be, we want to overwrite needed hash. And that would let us make that memcomp be true, even though we have no idea what the intended input is. Yes? Can you pass a null character to get us? Yes. You might reasonably ask, maybe get us shouldn't allow this? Well, get us is a function you shouldn't use anyways, but yes, you can. The specification of getUs is it reads up to the null line, copies that into a buffer, and adds a null at the end. The specification does not say it stops at a null character in the input. It only stops at the new line or end of file.
So you just can't
have
a new line.
You can't have a new line anywhere, yes. So a new line would be a problem. So if our needed hash that we wanted contained a new line, probably what we do is we change our something until it didn't. And we'll have a similar phenomenon when we're talking about our main topic for today, which is stack smashing, where we're going to have things we want to, input into buffers, and we're going to have to be concerned about, well, what characters can we use? Okay, so other questions about this example? Okay, so I'm going to talk as our main topic for next few lectures about stack smashing, which kind of revolutionized the buffer overflow game. And it's actually very old, but was kind of popularized with this name by a publication by Alf One, also known as Elias Levy. in the quote-unquote non-traditional literature. This is Frack magazine, distributed, yes, as text files that look like that. Smashing the Stack for Fun and Profit, which is basically a guide on how to do this on what was common at the time, 32-bit x86 systems. And what this innovation was is that, unlike my scenario in the chat I showed you there, where yes, we had this nice buffer overflow that was very convenient, but you know, it kind of relied on a lot of the context of the application. You know, so you know, if we were thinking about exploiting a real program, we have to do a lot of work to search for a place where not only is there a buffer overflow, but the buffer overflow is adjacent to something that is of special interest to the attacker. The kind of innovation of the stack smashing idea is they realized that if you have a buffer on the stack, it's already next to something interesting to an attacker, and you don't need to think about the context of the code very much to exploit it. There's this generic pattern that works at the time of the ALF1 paper every time you have a buffer on the stack. Doesn't matter. And to think about what happens here, let's have a kind of simple, vulnerable function. So I have a buffer, I read a string from standard in using something that's not checking the length of the string. And let's think about what happens if I input a 1,000 character string. Okay, so let's do that. I have 1,000 A's in a file, I input, and it segfaults. So why is it segfaulting? Well, let's pull up the debugger and find out. And we can see that the backtrace in our debugger is pretty interesting, that we're in this vulnerable function, and then the debugger thinks the things that call this function is all this 6-1s. So where did that come from? It's interesting. And also, we're at the end of this function here. So here's the assembly for the vulnerable function. So let's first figure out what is the stack layout here. We have our call to scanf. What's the stack layout look like? Okay, so we have 120 bytes allocated from this subtract. So we have 120 bytes set up across, and our argument to scanf, our second argument, is the stack pointer here. So we have this is where our scanf argument is. So this is what was called buffer in this C code. And something you'll notice, and something that happens quite frequently, is that the buffer is 100 characters in our C code, but the compiler rounded to 120. That happens. So we have 20 unused bytes. Okay. So what's above that? Anyone else? So, yeah. The return address for what? Okay, so this is this is the return address for vulnerable. Because the way our call and return instructions work on x86-64 is that they push a return address on the stack, so that happened before vulnerable started running, and our return at the end is supposed to pop a return address from the stack. So how about below in my picture? Is there anything going to be there? I mean, so below the buffer, what's going to be there when this function runs? Preferably someone who hasn't gone. Does the function do anything that pushes for more stuff onto the stack after the buffer? Yeah.
It calls.
So we're going to have the return address for scanf. And we're also going to have whatever scanf does to the stack below our buffer. Yeah. Wouldn't that be overwritten by the call?
To the call afterwards to do something.
Oh, yes. And then we'll have, and then this will get replaced by our do something with return address and whatever it puts on the stack. Yeah. So we also, below the buffer, we're going to have a bunch of stuff going on in the stack. So let's think about what our 1,000 A's did to stack. So here I have our stack layout. And in an example, you know, we tried to run, have our buffer run, and we went to, we have this layout here. We have our lowest address, the stack goes down in this picture. Lower addresses on the bottom, higher addresses on the top of the slide. And we put a bunch of A's. An A is in hex, 6 ones. So we filled up the whole buffer and also the unused space after it. And that's 120 characters. And we kept going. And so we overwrote the return address with a bunch of 6 ones, and we also overwrote a bunch of stuff after the return address with a bunch of 6 1 bytes. And when our debugger was displaying a stack trace, that's what it was being confused by. It expected to find, you know, where this function was called from by looking for return addresses on the stack. The first one it found was this 616161. And then it probably didn't know how that function worked, so it just assumed it was immediately followed by another return address, and another return address, and that's what it was showing us on the back trace. And as for, well, why did it segfault? What was happening when it segfaulted? If we look in the debugger, it would tell us, oh, this return instruction segfaulted. And the return address instruction didn't segfault because there was a problem reading the return address. It did that fine. But then it tried to jump there. I mean, that's not possible. There's nothing in our program, an address 6161, and so on. That's an invalid memory address, triggers a segfault. Some questions? What's going on here? Okay, so we could make it not invalid, though. Right. We know how the 6 ones got there, so we can put other stuff there. And this gives us the pattern that stack smashing has, that will overwrite the return address with an address of our choice. And we'll choose a very particular address, and that address will be the address of the buffer. And we will put at the beginning of the buffer the stuff we want to run. So the return instruction will read that address. It will jump to the code that's in this buffer. You might say, can you really execute code on the stack? Well, at the time of this vulnerability, absolutely. And it's only because we've taken specific steps to prevent this vulnerability from being as easy to exploit that that is not something that just works in every application. And in fact, there were legitimate uses of jumped into code on the stack in a bunch of software. So it wasn't just like, you know, it didn't tell you that the application was, that something malicious was going on. So this is the stack smashing pattern. And you can see that the only thing we need to do that's kind of application specific is figure out where the buffer is in memory and figure out how far it is from the return address. And that's not like super trivial. There's going to be some things that make that easier for us in practice. But this meant that unless we take some extra countermeasures, you know, any buffer on the stack, it's always going to have a return address after it. There's always going to be a return that uses that return address. This lets us exploit any stack buffer overflow pretty much. And this was kind of the most common way for a long time in the 90s that applications had exploits that result in an arbitrary code execution. So what do we need to do in this attack? So one thing is we need to write that machine code to jump to. And this is commonly known as, quote unquote, shellcode. Why is it called shellcode? Because the traditional thing that code would do is run a shell, run a command prompt. Because once you have a command prompt, you just input whatever commands you want, and you can do whatever you want to do. We also need to make this work. We need to identify the memory address where the shell code has been placed. So when it's read in, where will it be in memory? We need to know that address. And we need to insert that such that it overwrites the return address value, you know, by finding the correct location in the buffer. So you can see why I focused on like making us comfortable looking at the layout of stacks, because we want to find the stack where the stack pointer is relative to buffers. That's kind of an essential, important step here. And also, we want to compute where the buffer is. Knowing where it is in the assembly is going to make that a lot easier to do. So let's first talk about writing shellcode, since this is an important step. And there are a bunch of sort of other vulnerabilities like this where maybe we aren't dealing with the return address, but we'll have the same idea that we want to write code that we're going to fool the program into executing somehow. And often we'll have some restrictions in this code. So one thing, you know, we need is that this code kind of needs to work in ideally in any executable, or we need to customize it for the target executable. Right. So this isn't like writing a normal assembly program. So notably, for example, like I can't just call printf, because if I get machine code for that, the way that normally works is it calls a stub function that we'd have to have the linker figure out where that is. We are responsible for doing all of that ourselves when we're producing the shell code here. So like in the virus case, right, if you wanted to call like puts for tricky, that's actually a lot of work to do and very executable specific. You can't just do it like writing a normal assembly program where you just write call puts and the linker figures that out for you. And also, when we've done this attack, we kind of can't just keep running the application, at least not easily. And that's because we've kind of messed up the application's flow of control, right? What we want to do is we want to go back to where the return address used to point, and we've overwritten that information very deliberately. So most likely we're going to exit at the end or expect the application to crash when we're done. So let's look at modifying kind of a version of our virus code. So this is some code you might start with. And yeah, so you know, and we saw like this idea of writing a string and then returning. You know, if we just do this, this will crash. We can make our program behave more nicely by doing the same idea of making a request to the OS directly and doing an accept. So this is like the sort of code we'd use. So it's like similar to what we were doing in Turkey, but you know, in this case, I can't just return afterwards. So if I went to application to not give obvious signs of crashing, I can just exit normally, and that's what I'm doing here. And if we're thinking of kind of the common attack, instead of running this write operation, we do the equivalent of, on Linux, the system call is execve. This is run application. And we probably run binsh, which is the shell. But the same idea as the write call, we could do, you know, a common attack would be you run a shell and then input commands into that shell. But notice that we didn't write this. We aren't writing this like a normal way we do this. Like I did not write like call the write function here. I needed to do kind of operations in a way which works more consistently without relying on library functions, because you know we don't have a linker to help us out. So either we need to figure out how to call the library functions ourselves and like set up the offset in the call instruction, or we need to implement them ourselves. And usually it's easiest to implement them yourselves and make the system call directly. And yes, I have, we actually insert, you know, is the actual like bytes here, is that's what we put in our buffer at the appropriate location. So then we need to identify the memory address of the shellcode in the buffer. So we need to know where the buffer is to set that return address. And this is a case where we're going to run into some issues. Did I really not? Okay. I love not updating my slides, apparently. So, yes. So, one problem we'll have is that the location that the stack starts will be randomized. So we'll talk about that later. I was planning on talking about it now, but we'll assume we've dealt with that. So if the location the stack starts is the same, then this is consistent assuming the initial fact pointer is the same. And at the time of these vulnerabilities, the initial stack pointer was the same all the time. If you look at a modern program, that is not true by default. And okay. So let's do here and so do I have the do I really not have Wow. That is amazing what I don't add to my slides. Okay. So we'll say the initial stack pointer, so at time, this was sort of fixed. Now, the default is that this is randomized. And we'll talk more about it being randomized later, but that was a response to these attacks. By default, it used to be at a fixed location, and you can still enable it being at a fixed location on most systems because old programs might unfortunately expect that behavior. So if it starts at a fixed location, then we can kind of just run it in a debugger and look at its value and figure out what we want to do. And I promise I will have I was planning on talking about the randomization as a separate topic later. I just forgot to add the slides back and don't have a way of doing it quickly. But basically, if you don't take some countermeasures right now, you'll see the stack starts at a random location. At the time, this wasn't the case, and there are workarounds for that, which we'll talk about when we talk about, what randomization helps with and what it does not help with. So as an example here, here I have some code that does, reads into strings. And my question is, if I put my shellcode at the beginning of first, what is that address? And here in the debugger, I've stopped at the beginning of get initial. What is the address of first? Going to be. Okay, someone want to tell me what computation I should do, or one more time? So what should the value be? Or like, I don't want the number, just like, what calculation should I do to compute the address of first? No volunteers. Yeah.
So we can take the initial value that we had.
Okay.
And then we want to add on for the push.
Okay, so actually subtract, but yes. So minus 8 for the push.
And then minus OXA.
Minus OXA, 0, yep.
And then we can, first is just there.
Yeah, and then it's plus 0 because we're not adding anything when we're setting RSI, which is our second argument, to scanf. So another way, that's the right answer. Is if you were using a debugger, does anyone have other ways they would have found this out? So there's a way I assume some people would argue is easier, given that we have a debugger prompt here. Yeah. So we could set a breakpoint here and just check RSI's value at that point. Or probably, set a breakpoint here after RSI set and check RSI's value. And that might be easier. So that's probably part of our process for actually exploiting this. Okay, so let's see if I can, no. Okay, I'm not gonna do this quickly. Okay, so we'll just deal with something that is a bit of an annoyance here is even when we've turned off the randomization of the initial part of the stack pointer, the location varies. So here I have a program that just prints out RSP basically. And yeah, that's kind of annoying. Kind of annoying is that it depends on your arguments. I run the program. Seems like a practical issue. We kind of need to figure out exactly what's going on. And we're gonna have basically two solutions to this. I think I have mine. So this is like varying by a lot less than our bad case. So initially, now I have my final slides I wanted to show. Initially our stack location is like actually randomized like so. We can fix that, but even after fixing it, we have this problem that it still varies depending on how the program is run. So how do we deal with that, and why is that happening is our question. And why it's happening is because of how the program is run, is that we put information for arguments and its environment is pushed to the stack before main runs. So even though it's the same program, like how it runs actually affects where that stack pointer is. So it's not the same every time, even though it's deterministic, well, once we've turned off our address-based layout randomization, as it's called, which you see here, I can run this setArg command, which is going to be in our assignment for doing stack smashing that disables that randomization, but we still have the issue that the size of these strings that are pushed above our main vary, and we wanted to know the exact address of the shellcode, and that seems really annoying. So in the assignment, we have instructions for getting the stack address to be exactly the same every time to mitigate this, but you know, that seems kind of a thing that maybe you can't really manage in a real program. And there's a side of way around that. Now I can just adjust my shellcode, so I don't need to guess exactly. I don't need to know exactly where it is. I just need to know about where it is. So I just have a bunch of knobs at the beginning, and if I get the address here, or here, or here, or here, they're all going to work. So I don't need to know the exact address, I just need to get it with an 8, with a plus or minus 4. And, you know, when people are doing this in practice, you know, we might not have just 8 of these, you might have like, you know, 10,000. And so that's kind of the more common thing we'll do in this attack. We'll have our shellcode after what's called a knob sled. It's called a sled because we can slide down it wherever we start and get to our actual interesting code. And in this example, I'm showing our knob sled being before the return address. If we don't have enough space there, what we could do is we could have our knob sled up here followed by our shellcode, so we have more space for it. You know, if this space is pretty compact, we can just put it later, and that still works out, provided we can, you know, write the return address before. And so this is, you know, deals with that practicality, and this is why you'll notice that the randomization that is being done, that we'll talk more about later, you know, it's actually varying where the stack is by a lot. And it's because varying it by a little is not good enough to make this hard. And then we have to insert the overwritten return address value. So that's the full stack smashing attack. And so we have an assignment which is doing this attack on an example executable. And you know, that's what you'll do. And you know, you're just going to produce an input that overwrites the buffer with this type of strategy. And you're going to have your machine code that, in the case of the assignment, prints out the message you want it to print out in XSets probably, though that's not the only option. If we were doing a real attack, we'd probably like run a different program of our interest. I'm sorry for messing up my slides on. So, and kind of my advice for like figuring out how to do this is like a place I like to start is, you know, if you want to figure out where the return address is, just run it, trigger a set fault, see where it set faults, run it with a big input that like overwrites the return address, see where it set faults, that's where the return address is, where the stack is. Yeah. And we know it's not. Okay, so that's where we'll finish up today. So next time we'll look at the classic example of the like original stack smashing, which is the Morris worm, kind of as a review, and talk about some other practical issues with stack smashing, like what if my machine code contains characters I can't input? How do I deal with that? We're all finished up.
Thank you.